People are really mad at me about this Disco Elysium thing.
I don't know what Disco Elysium is because I'm not a pervert, so.
Honestly, that is a correct answer.
It's kind of a point-and-click adventure game with a bunch of other stuff over the top. It has what I would describe as leftist politics, what I think the makers of the game would also describe as leftist politics.
It's kind of like King's Quest, but for blue sky leftists.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty fair description. It's a good game. I mean, it won a lot of awards, and it deserved to win all the awards.
I watched some video of gameplay of it, and I'm sorry, it's not a game.
No, it's totally a game. It's just
It's a visual novel interactive.
No, thing. It's much closer to something like Planescape Torment than a visual novel.
It's like a multi-threaded digital novel, right? Like there's lots of different ways to get through it. You wind up identifying strongly with your character's decisions and all of this stuff. It's a good game, and people should play it.
I mean, it's a good game, but I don't think people should play it. Because it creates blue sky people.
And we're all in favor of blue sky, so...
Not these kind of blue sky people, George.
That's my question, though, is why do I need this game? I already have blue sky. I have 7 different kinds of leftists in my mentions at any given point in time.
7 is entirely too many.
I will say this about the game. This game unsympathetically presents all 7 of them to a shocking degree of accuracy. Like, you don't have to like any of them. This is a real feature of this game. You can be a total piece of shit to them, and they all deserve it.
So hold on. This game is a leftist game that does self-crit? I mean, this is really a leftist game, then.
So the reason it's currently kind of back in the discourse is that the studio that made it has split into 3 separate splinter factions, all of which claim they are the one true heir to the studio that made Disco Elysium.
Yep.
Definitely the most leftist game imaginable.
But it gets better. There were originally 2 creators of... this game, like the founders of the studio, who were kind of pieces of shit? Question mark? Let's go with pieces of shit. They got fired from their own studio. And then they were complaining that the studio still owned the game, and that was unfair. Which is sort of the genesis of one of the several Trotskyite splinter faction video game companies. But it gets weirder from there, because like, they then went and kind of admitted that the entire thing was just for tax purposes, like the entire company. And like, of course, they still owned the IP for the game. It was a very weird time.
And they split into like 3 studios, all of which are claiming to make the true sequel of this game.
Yeah.
And presumably all 3 of the sequels are going to be garbage.
Probably.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, that's not something you can do twice.
The game is also very Baltic State in mood. I mean, it's a bunch of Estonians who made the game, and that kind of shines through in both the immediate politics and also the visuals of the game. It is a good game. I don't mean to steer people away from the game. It will genuinely help your understanding of the world, maybe your understanding of leftist politics, if you play the game. But it is...
Just to be clear here, this podcast's official stance on understanding leftist politics is dumb.
And like, parts of it is a good call out, though, that like, this game is very close to a certain subgenre of game that you do generally find coming out of Eastern European countries. It's just much less violent than most of them, because you've got your Stalkers and your Metros and similar games, and then like, this comes out of left field, and it is very much an artifact of its time. Like, it's not like those games at all. I don't mean to like draw a comparison, but it does kind of have that very specific sort of attitude towards stuff. And then on top of it, it kind of got weird in sort of the time frame when it came out, because I'm sorry, you're going to have to hear these words. They put the Chapo people in the game.
Oh, God.
You're kidding me.
They did then remove them from the re-release, as far as I know.
Oh, they should put them back in. Oh, I would want to see that. I was going to say, yeah, it's nothing like Metro or Stalker, in that Metro and Stalker are actually good.
This little segment is really validating my I don't play video games vibe, and I feel great about that decision. Also, if any of you people listening to this are game developers and are thinking of putting us into a video game, I will be pissed if you do this. Do not do this. Do not put our podcast in a video game. Don't put any podcast in video games, but also don't put ours.
I mean, nobody knows what any of us look like, so.
Yeah, they do.
Not true about me.
Okay, well, not true of me and not true of Propter. Probably, yes, it is true. Definitely true of George, because he's got it in his profile picture. And
so do I. I'm just,
I guess, yeah, you sort of do too.
I'm just analog modified.
Yeah. George, I thought you were an Assassin's Creed guy.
I mean, I've played Assassin's Creed. I played some Assassin's Creed in college, but I've played some NCAA. I've played some FIFA. But in terms of actually dedicating hours to something, no, certainly not in the past half decade or so. I have other things to do with my time.
I just play games for like an hour before bed because I have a delightful TV and it would be a shame for it to go to waste.
Look, other people are welcome to play as many video games as they want.
No, you're not.
This is Normal Men, a podcast from four men who are clinging desperately to normalcy in an era when that's asking a bit too much. I'm George in Charlotte.
From DC, I'm Proctor Malone.
In outer Florida, I'm low-tax speedrun enjoyer.
And I'm Ed from Boston.
We've got a fantastic show for you this week. To start off, George and low-tax are going to be interviewing a very special guest about everything that's happening in the Levant and in Gaza.
One of the big subjects right now, nationally and internationally, that the Normal Men have not talked about a ton is the invasion of Gaza by Israel and the genocide that's underway there. There's a really good reason for us not talking about that in that we don't feel especially qualified to talk about it, and we don't have a lot of value add there, or at least we don't think we have a lot of value add there. We have opinions about it, but they're not very well informed compared to some of the other subjects we talk about. And so we wanted to bring in somebody who has extremely well-informed opinions about what's happening in Gaza and the history behind it, as well as where we might go from here. Leila Al-Sheikh is a Palestinian writer and activist with bylines in foreign policy, liberal currents, and dissent. You can follow her on Blue Sky at diplomatofnight.com, which is where you may have seen her posts. Emissary of Night is the name that she tweets under there or posts under there. And you can also subscribe to her newsletter at 2-hour-land.ghost.io. And we hope you do. So Leila, thank you so much for coming on Normal Men and talking to us about what's going on in Gaza right now.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to having a comprehensive discussion about where we are right now.
I think to have that comprehensive discussion, the most helpful thing is to go back not into the dawns of prehistory, which is where the roots of so much in that part of the world lie, but into a much more concrete place in the 20th century when the political setup that created the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis and has led to the sort of obscenities that have taken place since the October 7 attacks, as well as those attacks themselves, came from. So can you walk us through where this all sort of started in terms of the boundaries and the territory and the geopolitics of Palestine and Israel, starting probably in 1967, I think is the logical place to start, but correct me if I'm wrong there.
Absolutely. I think for the purposes of understanding the current situation, 1967 is a good place to start. But for a bit of a precursor, more of a overview, I think what a lot of people, as you alluded to, think is that the conflict is a millennium-long one or a innately religious one or something of that sort between two inherently juxtaposed groups, Muslims and Jews, right? But more accurately, it's best to be understood as a modern ethnic conflict between two competing national units, which have developed over time in the context of the European national model. After the Westphalian model became a thing in the 1600s, and after Zionism began to develop in the 1800s in response to centuries of European oppression against European Jewry. And contemporaneous to that development, there was also a burgeoning Arab consciousness developing throughout the Ottoman Empire. And these two sets of ideas were set on a collision course with each other, especially in the land of Palestine, or what would eventually become the mandatory Palestine territory under the United Nations after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And in that territory, there were Jews who had already lived there and Jews that were moving there under the auspices of various motivations, Zionists and non-Zionists, those who simply wanted to live there, and those who had the intent of building a Jewish homeland. Not necessarily a Jewish state. There was intense debate about what that might mean, but those who wanted to come there. And then there were Palestinian Arabs who were developing a Palestinian identity separate from that of wider Arab identity. And they also wanted sovereignty. Mandatory Palestine was set up as a legal entity which was meant to become eventually an independent state. It was one of the classes of mandatory systems which were nominally supposed to achieve independence, much like Jordan and Iraq. Eventually, after the horrors of the Holocaust in Europe, the Europeans and the West in general, including the Soviets and the Americans, saw it best to partition the territory of Palestine under the UNSCOP plan, the United Nations Select Committee on Palestine Partition Plan, which gave roughly 2/3 of the land to the Jewish people for the establishment of a state that would have roughly been 60% Jewish, 40% Arab, and the rest of it to a majority Arab population, which had encompassed the whole of the land prior to that. A civil war ensued in 1948, in which Zionist militias managed to decisively defeat Palestinians and the Arab armies which had invaded following. And in that process, both deliberate and as a result of war, there was the emptying out of Palestine of its Palestinians, what we call the Nakba, or the disaster. And that's where much of Palestinian national identity today comes from, this understanding that our society had been completely destabilized, completely uprooted and dismantled in the form of dispossession. And that dispossession continues to this day. It didn't stop in 1948. Something that I've told previous podcasts, like the Liberal Currents one, is that ethnic cleansing is best understood as a two-step process. One is the first part is the actual uprooting. It's the method of forcing someone from their homes. But the second part, and the more important part, is the denial of return, the refusal to allow someone to return to their home, regardless of the sovereign status of that place. And that's what occurred in the years following 1948. From 1948 to the mid-1950s, Israel passed a litany of laws, such as the Property Appropriation Act of 1951, which enabled the seizure of lands, villages, and homes that Palestinians had been emptied out of, and denied the return of those Palestinians to their homes. This created the refugee question. And in the following two decades or so, the question of Palestine lay mostly dormant. It was mostly understood as an Arab-Israeli conflict between sovereign states, and the refugees sort of receded to the background. But in the 1960s, the development of the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO, enabled the resurgence of the Palestinian question as a political question. And in the wake of 1967, which is what you alluded to earlier, in which Israel invaded and seized East Jerusalem, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai, and the Golan Heights, this question of Palestine became a resurgent question. And so, since then, the question of Middle East peace has become somewhat synonymous with the question of resolving the Palestinian political question. What will happen to the Palestinians? Under what framework will they have independence or none? And what is the status of the remaining occupied territories? The Sinai was eventually returned to Egypt after Egypt had stunned Israel in the 1973 war. And then in following that, the 1978 Camp David Accords, in which Egypt was given back the Sinai in return for normalization and an attempt to resolve the Palestinian question, which ultimately failed. And since then, we've had this limbo. Palestinians have been under occupation for roughly 58 years, I believe is the right number. My math might be a little off. Arithmetic's not my strong suit. But roughly six decades. And during this time, settlement has tripled from its initial number. There's over 800,000 Jewish settlers living in occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And today, there is a clamoring for a return to settlement in the Gaza Strip.
When we say settlement, can we define that? Because I think it's such an innocuous term. When you use settlement in normal English, it doesn't necessarily sound like anything ominous. But in the context of the occupied territories of Palestine, it really is an ominous process. So can you kind of define why that is the way it is? Like what settlement actually means?
Definitely. when people hear settlement, obviously, many people, I think, turn towards the settlement of the Americas, for example. And there's some similarities there in terms of the process. There's some similarities in terms of the motivation and so on. But in a modern legal and political context, the occupied territories, or the 1967 territories, as Arabs tend to refer to them, are a set of occupied territories under international law. They're territories which most states consider to be the sovereign territory of a state of Palestine, which already exists on paper, and which ought to exist in the future in their consideration. And so, under the international legal standards set up after 1945, which most states agreed to, including Israel, Israel is a signatory to most of the Geneva Conventions, if not all, under the Fourth Geneva Convention, the purposeful transfer of a civilian citizen of one state to the occupied territory of another is considered an act of war, or is considered a crime. And that's because the purpose of transfer is to change the demography of an area in order to perhaps obstruct any political changes or to consolidate one's ever-changing borders. And so that's often what people, when they talk of settler colonialism or when they talk of settlerism, that's the bulk of what they're referring to. We're talking about, say, East Jerusalem, which decades ago used to be a predominantly a much a far more majoritarian Arab city, a Palestinian city, as a result of changes that occurred from 1948 to 1967. It is now a city in which you have an Israeli state which occupies and governs it, incentivizing people, both Israeli and non-Israeli Jews, to come and move in to concretize its claim over the territory. And that's considered a criminal act under international law. And that's why it's such a contentious issue. And today there are roughly 800,000 Israeli Jews who live in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. That's roughly 1 in 10 Israeli Jews overall, which I think speaks to the pervasiveness of the settler project. It's not necessarily a fringe thing like it was in 1967 or 1968, in which a few people were setting up outposts against the wishes of the army. This is a state enterprise that has state backing. There are settlers who reside in the cabinet, there are settlers on the Supreme Court, and millions of dollars are allocated towards the civilian infrastructure of these settlements. And that's what a settlement is.
And I was going to say, as a matter of kind of mechanics, right? What seems to usually happen is the IDF will designate a certain area, a firing range, firing area, and thereby seize that land and force Palestinians out of it. Not force any Israeli settlers out of it. And in fact, free up the land to move additional settlers in.
Yes. This is a great example that you brought up, because this is actually the case of Masafer Yatta, which, if anyone listening knows of the movie No Other Land, if you have not seen that, that's what it's about.
Yes.
It's about a community. It's about a community in the South Hebron Hills called Masafer Yatta, which decades ago was declared a firing zone by the military. And there has been decades of litigation at the high court over this, whether or not it's a legitimate declaration. Of course, it's not a legitimate declaration under the international legal context. Military presence itself in the occupied territories is an illegal act. That's what the International Court of Justice ruled last year in its landmark opinion on the legality of the occupation. And I want to stress that that's a separate case from the ongoing genocide case. This was a case that was initiated years before October 7th. And so this is it's best to understand this as a belligerent occupation, which in of itself is an act of war if you were to consider the state of Palestine to be a de jure state. And settlements are a criminal act. It's a criminal act of war under the Fourth Geneva Convention. And that's sort of the context of the West Bank in legal parlance. It's not something that's often considered, but that's what it is.
So then, to advance this process forward through time to today, over the period from the mid-1970s through, let's say, the let's say early 2020s, there was this process of sort of slow erosion of the conception of a Palestinian state and of Palestinian rights that led to primarily that, like, I think is the best way to think about it is the settlements and the forced expulsion of Palestinian people from their land and the expansion of Israel into Palestinian territory. But in other ways as well, internal to Israel, there were a variety of changes that sort of turned it into a more ethnically driven state. But there's sort of this prevailing view from the West that, well, we can find a solution here. We can find some sort of peace process, whether you're Clinton trying to do this in the 1990s. There's, you know, every presidential candidate gets asked about it and has a throwaway answer, but sort of nothing really happens. And there's this erosion in the background. Is that sort of a fair way to characterize? I know there I'm glossing over a couple of major events, such as, for instance, the Intifadas. But I think there really was a rupture on 10/7. So I want to sort of establish a continuum there, like through time of this erosion and how we got to the really big step change in policy towards Palestine from Israel following the attacks on October 7th.
Yes, I think you've got the contours broadly right. It's best to, when I referenced earlier, the transformation of the question of Palestine into a political question, it's best to remember that prior to 67, the Palestinians, despite existing, despite being a group which had a consciousness, which had a national literature, poetry, an understanding of what had happened to them in 1948, they were virtually invisible on the international stage. And to the extent that they were ever referenced, they were referenced as the Arab refugee question, to be resolved in a humanitarian way, not necessarily a political way. But after 1967, paradoxically, once Israel had become the master of all of historic Palestine, Palestine had resurged as a concept. It had re-emerged as a political contest. By taking all of this territory, Israel had reignited the question. And since then, there have been a variety of attempts to resolve this on a political level, on a legal and political level, beginning with Carter, in which he tried to resolve it with a multilateral peace conference jointly endorsed by the U.S. and the USSR. This eventually fell through in the direction of a more limited bilateral agreement between Egypt and Israel, in which Israel vaguely committed to the process of giving autonomy to the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Not statehood, and certainly not equal footing, but a form of autonomous rule under Israeli and Jordanian and Egyptian auspices. That was sort of the framework that existed for Palestinians. And that had a great deal of influence on the Oslo Accords, in which the PLO was transformed into what is now understood to be the Palestinian Authority, which has limited civil governments and responsibilities in the occupied territories. It is not a state, and it's certainly not even, I would say, an autonomous government. It's a putative vassal regime of sorts. It's sort of a subcontractual system for the military occupation. It makes it easier for Israel. The PA picks up the garbage. The PA governs Palestinians on behalf of Israel, not on behalf of Palestinians, and so on. And this sort of co-option and rejection of statehood and the failure to take this transitional period into statehood, whether it be in 2000 or 2008, or in the latest opportunity, 2014, it created a crystallized and permanentized system of being in between for Palestinians. It's not ignored on the international stage, not completely shoved off, considered still to have legitimate aspirations, but also no real effort being made towards realizing that end. And after the failure of the 2014 talks, the U.S. had become broadly disinterested in the issue. When Donald Trump became president during his first term, he attempted to craft a peace plan that might finally resolve the issue, but it was a woefully lopsided one, which allowed Israel to annex large swaths of the West Bank and for a putative state of Palestine to be declared that would be a Swiss cheese map of tunnels and roads between urban exclaves. This obviously fell through. It didn't happen. And in lieu of that, Trump adopted something called the Abraham Accords, which allowed for states like Bahrain and the UAE and Morocco to normalize relations with Israel, despite never having actually been at war with Israel, in order to benefit in terms of weapon sales, economic integration, all of this. This doesn't sound necessarily sound a big, like a big deal, right? But from the Arab perspective, normalization with Israel without the resolution of the Palestinian question is tantamount to undermining the question of Palestine. It's implicitly agreeing with the concept that we can be brushed aside. And it's in this context that frustration and despair began to set in among the more militant factions of Palestinian resistance, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the DFLP, the PFLP, and so on. And it's in this context that that the operation called Al-Aqsa Flood, more commonly understood as the October 7th attacks, began to crystallize. There was this understanding that the question was receding from the international view, that West Bank acceleration in terms of settlement and annexation was creeping, and that no one would do anything unless there was a turning of the table, sort of an apocalyptic, semi-apocalyptic worldview, that something had to be overturned for something to change, a roll of the dice. And so that's what occurred, an attempt to upend the status quo in a horrific way, in a way that's had horrendous consequences, but also in a somewhat perverse and depressing way, successfully has recentered the question of Palestine. It took something like that to make the West pay attention again to the question. And that's, I think, where we are now. We're 2 years into a fundamental despair and a understanding that this does have to be solved, but how exactly?
Regardless of all of the horrible things you can say about the Al-Aqsa Flood operation and the, I mean, obviously it killed a lot of completely innocent, other than their citizenship, I mean, which doesn't make them any less innocent people. But it was extraordinarily successful at changing the status quo. It didn't change it for the better. And in fact, it changed it for the worse in almost any imaginable way, but it certainly changed things. And I can still remember seeing some of the initial posts coming out of the incursions into Israeli territory and thinking like, oh man, this is not going to go good. And it has created this permission structure from the international community that has allowed Israel to enact horrific vengeance on the civilian population in Gaza, supported by directly the United States in terms of both financial and military support, but also given important rhetorical cover from both sides of the aisle. I mean, in the United States, the most pro-Israeli people are the lunatic right-wing fundamentalists, but not far behind them are some of the leaders of the Democratic Party. So you've seen this issue become completely untenable in the past couple of weeks because for whatever reason, and we'll talk about it, there's been a recognition from sub-leadership members of the Democratic Party, both rank and file voters, if you look at surveys or actual elected officials, that the status quo can't hold. There's now a horrible famine in Gaza that is killing maybe as many people as Israeli bombs have so far, on top of 2 years of military interventions that have killed, Leila, I think you would have a better handle on the numbers than I would, but thousands of people. What is the casualty count at this point in Gaza over the past 2 years?
Well, first, I would just like to say one other thing about the
police. Of course, yes,
discussion.
Please.
But I would like to say, to be clear, like certainly what happened in October 7th and in the days that followed was a horrific thing. And it would be wrong to say that that didn't happen or any of that sort. But the political incentive, the incentive structure of the Middle East has become very perverse in the sense that it takes a certain kind of belligerence for anyone to believe that a political solution is necessary to a political problem. Without conflagration of hostilities, like in May 2021 or in the 2018 attacks or in the 2014 attacks, much of the world is content to simply look at the problem and say, well, it'll never be solved. And so Israel may be allowed to gradually impose its own solution. And that's an incentive structure that enables the type of things that you see in October 7th. And so a political solution is necessary. And I think that's something, to your point, what we're just about to discuss, is something that more and more people are beginning to realize. If this is a structure that is not sustainable, if apartheid is not sustainable, or if a system in which 7 million people's national aspirations are in a logjam or in perpetual stagnation, and 7 million other people have full enfranchisement and rights, there's going to be a constant friction. And so there needs to be a resolution of that. And so after 2 years, and I would say I am not an expert on casualty, I'm not an expert on the ways in which one calculates death toll, but numerous reports from The Economist and from high-ranking United Nations bodies put the casualties at least around 100,000 dead, and many more injured, 80,000 plus injured. I believe a recent report by the Washington Post put it around 50,000 children killed or maimed. They listed names of many of these children. And if you scroll on that page, it tells you names at like every hundredth or 1,000th, and then tells you how many you've read. It's a very harrowing article. But I think because of the immense casualties, and because of the immense amount of images of starvation coming out, you are starting to see a bit of a crack in the wall of ideological support and of indifference from U.S. elites, from the commentariat, from Europeans. And that was what was reflected yesterday in that vote. And I think partly what was reflected in New York a couple of weeks ago with the mayoral primary.
Yeah, some of the polling that we saw coming out of the mayoral primary aftermath was really remarkable. I mean, you're talking super majorities of really like the bluest blue Democrats, right? Like people who are voting for Democrats in New York City primary elections are as close to a representation of the base of the party as you're going to get, I think. I mean, I don't know how you get more basey than that. And you're talking, you know, 80%, 70 plus percent approval for policies that elected officials leading the Democratic Party have opposed for years. And we're seeing actual movement from other elected officials as well. There was a vote this week in the Senate proposing to ban weapon sales to Israel following United States existing law, basically, that prevents weapons transfers to countries that are conducting genocides, essentially. I mean, that's what it boils down to. And we shouldn't be sending weapons, but we are. And so a statement vote in the Senate, a messaging vote, and a majority of the Senate caucus for Democrats backed the legislation, which is a huge change from relatively recently. And you saw folks, one good example is Senator Ossoff in Georgia, who's up for re-election in 2026. He had previously voted for a similar sort of amendment in the Senate, received a lot of flack from Jewish communities in Georgia, reversed his vote at the next stage of the legislation, and then now, several months later, has come back and voted in favor again, which I think is a very clear message of how quickly the ground has shifted. So from where you sit, I know your focus is more on Palestine, but how has the landscape shifted now versus 6 months ago, or, you know, let alone now versus how Americans would have thought about this politically prior to 10/7?
Yes, I think that's the real question. When you say prior to, I think there are two things I think that are important to remember. One being that the trend line of public opinion is such that you can observe it having gone in this direction for at least 10 or so years. I would put it around 11 years, actually, because after the collapse of the last real attempt at peace talks between Israel and the PLO in 2014, you begin to see a fundamental shift in dynamic between the perception of the Israeli government and the state itself and what leadership in the United States still holds on to. After 2014, you have a state of Israel which no longer makes pretense about peace processes or partition, and you have a overwhelmingly right-wing political leadership which antagonizes democratic officials like even President Obama. And simultaneous to this, you have a domestic political development in the United States on Black Lives Matter. You have the events in Ferguson, you have the events in Baltimore, and eventually you have George Floyd. And so you have a lot of young people who are developing a sense of racial justice and a sense of political frustration with police brutality, with authoritarianism as a political concept. And at the same time that they're doing that, they also see a new globalized media structure, which gives them insight into the occupation of the West Bank and the military bombardments, the periodic military bombardments of Gaza, 2018, 2021. I think if I remember right, I might be off on the exact dates, but George Floyd died in May 2020, I believe, or thereabouts. And just a few weeks later, Israeli police shot an autistic Palestinian man from East Jerusalem point blank. And that was an international outcry as well. And those two events, I think, sort of crystallize this concept that young people have in their minds, that this is an apartheid system, or that at the very least it's an intensely racial segregation system, and that it's unjust, and that it parallels to their experience seeing what's happening here in the United States with the history of Jim Crow. And so there's that, but then there's also what's happening in Gaza. And you call it a genocide, and I, of course, also call it a genocide. And I want to say, for those who may be listening who may still yet have questions about that word, whatever one might think about the initial justification of the attacks, obviously I have my view as a Palestinian. I come with my preconceptions. I come with my view of Israeli leadership and so on. The act of a genocide is the intent to destroy in whole or in part the capacity to live for a people. And so over time, you've seen this crystallization of a consensus that it is a genocide, not just because of the death toll. I think a lot of people think about it in terms of death tolls, but also Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, both of those reports. Human Rights Watch issued their genocide conclusion last year, and B'Tselem just a few days ago. Both of them, I think it should be noted, don't make the determination based off of death toll. Make the determination based off the denial of water, the destruction of hospitals, the destruction of desalination plants, the destruction of food crops, and the destruction of civilian infrastructure such as entire neighborhoods. That's the determination that they make, and it hinges on that. It hinges on the uninhabitability of the Gaza Strip as a goal of the state of Israel. And that sort of thing is what has compelled this change. Now people, I think, are beginning to see that, well, it's not just about dismantling Hamas, or it's not just about returning the hostages. It's about exacting a price on the idea of the Gaza Strip itself, destroying whole neighborhoods, making it nearly impossible to acquire food or water. And that's why we're here now. That's why people like Amy Klobuchar voted against sending military assistance yesterday. And like Ossoff as well, who took a brave stance after taking a lot of flack from his communities in Georgia. And so I think, like Professor Shipley Tohami said a couple of days ago, we're in this weird state of flux where the leadership is still clinging to this idea that doesn't exist. And more people who are younger are going to come into power and come into the echelons of developing policy and steering the direction of the party with the idea in their head that the state of Israel has committed one of the worst atrocities of the 21st century. That's what's going to influence them for years to come.
I also just want to say, as a father, I have a daughter who's 2.5 years old, and it is incredibly difficult for me to look at some of the photographic and video evidence of what's come out of Gaza since 10/7, both in terms of the consequences of bombs falling and the consequences of food being denied, food and water being denied, and other medical care. Even before I had kids, I was very affected by any media that involved children being hurt. I don't know, you know, everyone's got different things that bug them. And it was just one of those things I had a really hard time with. I can remember watching the episode, it goes back to when Game of Thrones was on and the Red Wedding episode came out, and how viscerally disturbed I was by that. You know, like it's just one of those things for me. So I will say I have in a lot of ways avoided some of the content that's come out of Gaza, and I have not made it made a priority to consume it. And I just want to say that you can be aware of what's going on in Gaza and have an opinion on it and have a view about whether it's just or not without necessarily mainlining that kind of stuff. And I, you know, since we're talking about the horrors of what's happened, I just wanted to throw that out there for listeners that, like, you don't have an obligation to look at this stuff all day. But I do think we all have an obligation to be aware in general terms of what's happening, even if you're not spending all day watching what in some cases are snuff films, really. I mean, I hate to be insensitive, but I think that's sort of where a lot of this stuff goes. And you can do so much without actively hurting your brain with that kind of stuff. And so I just want to throw that out there for our listeners as far as ways you can engage with content around this from reporters, from experts like Layla, from on the ground testimonies that aren't just consuming the human pain that some of these videos entail.
I agree.
In ways that I think actually can be quite harmful to the people watching them.
Yeah, be informed. Don't traumatize yourself. You're not saving any lives or making the world a better place by traumatizing yourself.
I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah. Even like the images that like the New York Times put out, I have a difficulty looking at those because I see my family and all of those things. So I wholeheartedly agree with other people.
Yeah.
I think speaking to the domestic political picture, we are fascinated here. Our group chat has been fascinated by the dynamic that Democrats' leadership has gotten themselves into in Congress, because both the Senate and the House are led by New York Democrats. New York being one of the largest concentrations of Jewish people in the world outside of Israel. In fact, the largest concentration of Jewish people in the world outside of Israel, and one of the largest in the world, period, has traditionally been this bastion of support for Israel, come what may. Prior to 10/7, that was a contradiction or a contradictory sort of view of the world that even in the post-George Floyd environment could be managed and could be looked past as just one contradiction among many in a very broad political coalition. But since, you know, when we're talking about mass starvation, death toll in the six figures, bombing of civilians, you know, utter destruction of infrastructure, plans to essentially permanently take the land of Gaza in some cases. We're talking about that contradiction heightening to a completely unsustainable degree. And just on an interpersonal level, how Hakeem Jeffries in the House and Senator Schumer, Chuck Schumer in the Senate manage their caucus when public opinion isn't with them, when the votes are not really with them anymore, when the electorate in the places they represent is no longer with them, how do you continue to push forward with the same old story of, well, Israel is our strongest ally in the region and they're an important democracy and they have a right to defend themselves and we need to keep selling them weapons and providing them aid? It's very hard to see how they can continue to do that without major negative repercussions.
Yes, I think one thing that a lot of people make a fundamental analytical mistake in doing when talking about, say, New York, we're talking about the Democratic coalition, is assuming that there is a strict binary of being a diehard pro-Israel individual or being a diehard, whatever one might call, I don't necessarily like the term pro-Palestine, but pro-Palestine individual. Like they think it's Rashida Tlaib or Josh Gottheimer, right? And putting aside that the general position of the Democratic electorate is much closer now to Tlaib than Gottheimer, put that aside, I think something that people tend to mistake is Jewish Americans, based on the polling, and I say this is purely based off of the polling. Obviously, I'm not an American Jew and I can't speak on behalf of American Jews, but purely based off of the polling that you can see, Jewish Americans have a multitude of opinions about what's been happening. A recent poll by, and I'm going to forget the name of the institute, but it's an institute that polls both Israelis and American Jews. A recent poll this week found that something like 44% of young American Jews believe that this is a genocide. Like, that's an active debate that's happening in American Jewish society. And I mean, beyond that, you have young Black people, young Latinos, young Muslims and Arabs who are continuing to attempt to enmesh themselves in party politics in a way that they haven't been able to before, as the legacy of 9/11 recedes. This stuff is all going to constantly shift the dynamic. And so I think even today, the funeral for the police officer who was tragically killed in New York a couple of days ago, one of his fellow police officers decried the genocide in Gaza. And that was with Eric Adams in the front row and Cuomo in the audience as well. Like, this is a thing that's not going to go away for people. It's not a
famous liberal squishes, the NYPD.
Yes, I believe the officer was a Muslim, of course, but you know, like, nonetheless, like, this is a thing that's not going to go away. And so, yeah, this is a legitimate political opinion now. It's really, I think that's something that some people continue to grapple with and don't seem to understand. This is a real live political constituency now that believes that this is happening and sees what's happening and says what it is. And I think even if I go back and forth, I discuss with Peter Stern, an excellent reporter from City and State New York, who's done some of the best reporting on the Mamdani campaign. I've gone back and forth with him on what, like, how quickly things will occur. But I don't think it's possible anymore for a stalwart pro-Israel, uniformly pro-Israel position to be the consensus of the party. Even Richie Torres, I think you've seen, has tried to...
That was the one that really caught my eye. He basically has been doing his best to be Israel's best friend in the House.
Yes.
And he represents a very, very poor district from the Bronx. I'm sure that he has Jewish constituents, but his district is Black and Latino, like, heavily, and very, very low socioeconomic status. And so making himself the face of such a foreign policy oriented issue is just always kind of didn't make sense in terms of representing his constituents. But on top of that, he was so strident, not as strident as someone like Fetterman has become, but very strident in terms of being pro-Israel. And even he this week has had to start saying, look, I can't support this anymore. I need to back off. And to me, it feels like there has been a change on the ground in his district. I think I said this to you on Blue Sky, actually, Layla. It feels like someone gave him a call and said, listen, buddy, we're done. Like, this is not going to fly anymore.
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think he said, it beyond his even like his remarks to Chuck Todd, which are the ones that went viral, I think he also said in some interview on like some smaller YouTube podcast of some sort, like he analyzed this to Iraq, basically. He said this is a quagmire, that it's going to permanently erode the status of Israel in a geopolitical sense. And I think that really gives you a insight into how some of these people are believing things now. They see that in 5 years or 10 years, they're going to be asked by constituents. They're going to be asked by, if he runs for higher office, he's going to be asked, well, what did you do when this was happening? What did you do when the cards were on the table? And if he doesn't have a sufficient answer, then it may not necessarily be a decisive issue, but it's going to be something that people will remember. And I think that's an important factor in driving elite opinion, being able to see what the winds are blowing in. Because even with Iraq, like, it's not necessarily like it was a decisive issue in 08, but Obama attacked Clinton on the Iraq war. It will be an issue in the future, what you did in terms of Gaza and what you did in terms of the Palestinian question. And more broadly, it'll be an issue whether or not you fundamentally believe that this is a political question that needs to be resolved in favor of Palestinian rights.
So with that in mind, I think some of the goings on abroad have also been important in cementing that status as a political question, because we're starting to see a wave of foreign leaders of developed countries that are not the United States. They exist. We sometimes pretend that they don't. And I was actually born in one of them, believe it or not. We've seen a wave of recognition from foreign developed countries. France was maybe the most dramatic, where Emmanuel Macron basically came out and said, we're going to recognize the state of Palestine. That is something that has historically been a no-go for a wide range of countries for a bunch of different reasons. Can you talk through the sort of history of recognition and what some of the movement we've seen on that issue might entail for the state of Palestine and for the Palestinian people?
Yeah, I think something that very few people in my experience know, even like just conceptually know is or aware of is that the state of Palestine as a legal entity came into being in 1988. The Palestine Liberation Organization, which is the official body, the representative body of the Palestinian people in international fora since the 1970s, they declared independence. They issued a declaration of independence in the fall of 1988 from Algiers, which stated that the state of Palestine exists side by side with the state of Israel on the basis of UNSCR 242 and UNGAR 194. And for those who don't know, 194 is the resolution that adopted the United Nations Partition Plan in 1947. And 242 is the resolution which established the land for peace model, which entails the relinquishing of the occupied territories in exchange for normalization with Israel. And so the state of Palestine adopted these measures in 1988. And in the immediate weeks and months that followed, the vast majority of the world recognized the state of Palestine as a de jure state, which functions in exile from the occupied territories. That was done in response to the first Intifada, in which it was really the first mass public open uprising against the occupation and the occupied forces. And recognition sort of stopped in its tracks, though, in 1993, when the PLO accepted something less than a state in the form of a transitional government called the Authority. The state of Palestine still exists as a de jure entity, but it sort of exists in parallel to and not in singularity with the Authority. And so for the last 25, 30 years, most governments have dealt with the Authority rather than necessarily the idea of a state of Palestine. But in 2011, Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas as most people know him, we call him Abu Mazen, in 2011, he adopted a newer, more internationalistic framework for pursuing the legitimization of the state of Palestine. He attempted to join the United Nations as a full member state. Obama actually vetoed this and even pulled funding from certain organizations like UNESCO for a brief period of time because of the state of Palestine joining, which underscores the depth to which bipartisan American opposition to Palestinian independence exists, or has existed anyway. But since 2011, the state of Palestine has worked hard to garner more recognition, and it's really tried to garner Western recognition. Like you said, it's the Western powers which have broadly refrained from recognizing Palestine. If you look at a map from a few years ago of recognition, it's almost the entirety of the Eastern world and Latin America, and then it's Western Europe and America and Canada and Australia, which have been intransigent in terms of recognizing. And now with the context of October 7th and the genocide, the leaders like Macron view recognition as an investment of sorts, a value statement to a degree, but also an investment in the preservation of this two-state idea. The two-state idea has been corroded, it's been overridden by reality of settlement, it's been receding because of the Israeli political consensus being against Palestinian statehood. But Macron wants it to come back. Saudi Arabia and France have tried very hard to preserve it through a litany of diplomatic endeavors. And so Macron took the somewhat brave step of recognizing the state of Palestine without conditions, I might add. He initially had conditions that he had put out in the early part of the year, and Abu Mazen had conceded to some of them, but not all. And Macron had met him halfway, and now France will recognize the state of Palestine no matter what in September. And following that, Starmer in the UK and Carney in Canada have also issued conditional recognitions, which I personally think will eventually be dropped. It will become an unconditional recognition in September. And so by the end of the year, the United States may very well be the only Anglospheric country left that doesn't recognize Palestine.
Feels hard to imagine that we will get recognition from the United States for Palestine under the Trump administration. Under a Democrat in the next presidential term, who knows? That could be contested ground, but it just seems impossible.
Yes,
I think for the foreseeable future from the United States, which only serves to heighten the contradiction of our political engagement with the state of Israel and how it treats the people of Palestine.
Yes, I think for those who would like to know more about this sort of diplomatic minutia, because it's a bit heavy-handed, I think when I try to talk to people about it, they tend to think, well, what does any of it matter? Like, recognition is a symbolic act, and that's certainly true. Like, Palestinians can't eat recognition. That's what often we say. That's what, if you ask any analysts from Ramallah or from Jerusalem what they think of it, they'll say, well, we can't eat recognition. What does that do for people in Gaza? And I more or less agree. I think the EU should take more meaningful steps, like curtailing trade, imposing embargoes on settler goods, and so on and so forth. And also, I'm not necessarily a two-stater, but recognition is our right, I think, as a legal principle. It is our right to have our principle of self-determination recognized. And so that's a meaningful thing. It's a meaningful distinction to be made by France. And Macron has, I think, restored a bit of credibility to himself and to France by taking that step that Spain, Ireland, Norway, and the majority of the world had already taken. Like, this is a thing that it is a necessary precondition to recognize Palestine in order to be a genuine mediator for peace. You can't be Israel's lawyer and be the mediator like the United States has been. So that's a necessary step. I think it's a step that should be considered as meaningful and as a break from the past, I think. For those who are listening, you know, if you follow me, you might see me often argue with people about two states versus one state. And that's just a bit of like minutia of fun. Like these things are so far out in the future as feasible things. I personally don't think the two-state process has ever really guaranteed us a form of justice. But I think even if you are a two-stater, or if you're a one-stater even, the real question isn't necessarily what is the end framework, although I think that matters. But the question is if you think it's a political question in the first place. If you think that in order for there to be meaningful peace, Palestinian political and legal rights are a prerequisite, the realization of them are a prerequisite. If you believe that, you're broadly in my camp, and I think you're broadly in the camp of the majority of young people. You're broadly in the camp of people who want this to end. And so that's what really matters. I think a lot of older Democrats and a lot of Republicans, the whole of the Republican Party, and a lot of older Democrats, they had this sort of arrogant view that Palestine could be brushed to the side. Because the Abraham Accords, that's the whole premise. The premise of Saudi Arabia can be best friends with Israel. The UAE can be best friends with Israel. Everyone can be best friends if we just ignore that little problem of the military occupation of 5 million people. You can't do that. That's not possible. And that's what led to October 7th. That's what led to this. If you ignore the problem, the underlying problem, then it will only explode. And so no matter what your end position is, if you agree that my rights, that the people of Palestine's rights, are an innate part of the problem, an innate part of the solution, rather, then I agree with you. That's how we work together to resolve this issue.
Well, we certainly agree with you on that point, and this has been really, really helpful for helping us think through a really dark chapter of the current global order and what will become history at some point. And so, Layla, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Layla.
If you'd like to follow Layla, you can do that on Blue Sky at diplomatofnight.com. You can also subscribe to her letter to-our-land.ghost.io. And once again, Layla, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to fix the jobs reports very strongly, folks.
And by fix, we mean completely fictionalize or
possibly remove the testicles from. We had some news this week. The monthly jobs report dropped on Thursday, and it included significant downward revisions for the past 2 months. As a direct response to the jobs report that included significant downward revisions for the past 2 months, President Trump promptly fired the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This has caused a great deal of anguish in certain wonk circles because the Bureau of Labor Statistics is the alpha and the omega of labor statistics for the United States of America.
Yeah, I mean, normally I'm really in favor of causing wonks agony, but like, this one seems to be affecting George, and I'm not sure I like that. So maybe we could get some details.
Yeah. Okay. So first, let's talk about what happened on Friday in terms of the job report. So very, very large miss in terms of the number of jobs that were created over the period from April to June. And the reason that was a miss is because prior jobs reports were revised down. Why do we get those downward revisions? Well, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics goes out and calculates what's called the establishment survey, which measures the number of jobs by asking businesses how many people they employ. They don't always get exactly the right number of responses in the first month on time for the monthly release, which is the first Friday of the month after the jobs report. So for instance, the July jobs report was released for that month on August 1st, which was Friday. We're recording this Sunday, August 3rd. So the May and June numbers were revised down significantly, as well as a slightly lower, not dramatically lower, but slightly lower than expected reading for July as well. And those downward revisions were broad, but they were really concentrated in one area, which is state and local education. So basically school teachers, public school teachers. For some reason, the BLS thought there was a lot more job creation from school teachers in especially June, but also in May, then there really should have been. And we actually flagged this in real time in our research and said, this is like a weird thing. And I don't know, maybe it's right, but you know, it doesn't look like a seasonal adjustment issue, but who knows? Turns out for whatever reason, there were more jobs created than expected there. So they came out and said, no, actually the jobs creation numbers were very weak. So basically instead of going from a pace of 150, 200,000 jobs a month, which is what roughly what we were trending before the tariff announcement started to hit in March and April, we're now talking about 100,000 jobs over 3 months. So like 30,000 or even less on average. And that obviously pissed off the president quite substantially. We don't know for a fact, because this is Trump, because there is an enormous amount of bluster, we don't know for a fact that whoever they choose to replace the BLS commissioner will juke the statistics. But when you fire someone for reporting bad statistics, that is a pretty reasonable assumption to make, that going forward, that person will change the statistics in order to keep their job. Not a great time to be someone whose whole job is analyzing economic data.
Not so easy as just firing the one person, though.
Correct.
BLS is a pretty large agency. I don't know how large exactly it is. It's probably, I don't know, a couple thousand people. There are many more steps I think we're going to have to go through here to get to a place where the data are just complete garbage and he's pulling the wool over everybody's eyes.
Correct. And if we do go down that road, it's going to be very visible in the data. It's really hard to manipulate economic statistics in a way that's not obvious. And the reason for that is they are very complicated. If you say, oh, well, we actually employed 300,000 people this month instead of 14,000 new jobs, whatever your number, you have to then make that internally consistent with a bunch of different stuff. The different geographies that are creating jobs, the different metros that are creating jobs, the different industries that are creating jobs. And you also then have to be able to show that that ties out to other surveys that or other data sources like tax records. And doing all that is without making it blatantly obvious that that's what you're doing is really, really hard to do.
The good thing is that this is not a terribly broad survey. And the Trump administration, if you give them nothing else, these are guys for whom attention to detail is always the highest priority.
Naturally.
But in all seriousness, to your point, George, even incredibly smart people trying to manipulate data like this would get caught pretty quick with other experts looking at it, especially the vast swath of, you know, wonky people you see on Blue Sky or Twitter or wherever. For these guys to try to do it, they're going to get caught in like a nanosecond.
To be clear, though, the fact that we think we're going to be able to catch if there is manipulation of the data doesn't mean that we're going to be able to get the right numbers. It just means we're going to be able to tell that somebody's lying to us.
Correct. Correct. And the ironic thing is that the news is going to get worse for Trump on jobs before it's going to get better. We're going to put our wonk hats on here and talk about what the employment situation report, which is widely referred to as payrolls every month, but it's the monthly snapshot of the labor market that's the sort of top, like the most important release every month, along with maybe CPI, which is also a BLS product.
CPI is the consumer price index for those who are not invested in following economic data.
And don't get invested in following economic data. It's the most perverted thing you can engage in.
Especially right now.
Ever. Don't. It's bad. We're bad people.
It would be even worse than getting involved in gaming.
Way worse. It's yes. Yeah. Okay. So there's two surveys that get mashed together in this one giant report. And when I mean giant, I mean like thousands of different individual data series with seasonal adjustment, different geographies, different industries, different measures of wages, hours, unemployment. It's extremely detailed. It's a huge release, and it's produced through two surveys. One of those surveys is the household survey, which is run off of the current population survey, which is a census survey product. The household survey does measure employment, but it's not as good of a measure of employment as the current establishment survey, which is a survey of businesses. And if you ever hear someone say payrolls, that's referring to the establishment survey.
Yeah, the household survey covers something on the order of a 20th of a percent of all employees in the United States as a sample size, whereas the establishment survey covers somewhere between a quarter and 30%. Of all employees in the United States. It's a much, much larger sample.
Yeah. And the nice thing about the establishment survey is that we can tie it out to tax data. So every year, and this is where the news is going to get worse. Every year, there is a process where the BLS goes back and looks at their statistical sample, a survey that goes out to businesses and businesses respond to, and compares it to what they know happened based on actual hard administrative payroll tax data. It's a way to sort of check their work in the rearview mirror. And it's really important to do this because every day, week, month, quarter, year, businesses are opening their doors and closing their doors. And if a business opens their doors, it's really hard to account for them in a statistical sample because you don't know to sample them because they've just opened their doors. And same for a business that closes.
BLS evocatively calls this the birth-death adjustment.
Yes. So they have a statistical model to estimate this from month to month, right? In other words, they don't know how many businesses opened and closed in July, but they have a statistical model that says this is the amount we think based on historical trends typically would, and that it would have XYZ effect on employment. So you can estimate that annual benchmark revision using a quarterly survey that is different from the current establishment survey that is very comprehensive, but not as comprehensive as tying out individual payroll tax records. And so Goldman Sachs came out with an estimate this week. All the Wall Street banks that have big economics departments will estimate this. Goldman Sachs came out with an estimate this week that estimated an downward revision on the order of 550 to 950,000, which is similar to last year. But last year was a very large one, and they're looking for something similar again. Okay, so what does that mean? It means that the level of employment in March of 2025 is expected to be revised down by that number. That then means that the level of employment for the months prior to that date, so March 2024, 2025 back to March 2024, and months after March 2020, April 2025 through July 2025, or by the time we get this data in September, August will be in there as well, they'll be revised down too. So instead of eking out 13, 15,000 monthly job gains in June and May, we could see negative numbers there. That's a plausible thing that you could forecast based on that estimate of what the benchmark is going to be revised down.
And so Trump is going to immediately try to fire Mr. Goldman.
Yes. The vampire squid, he's going to go Moby Dick that thing.
Yeah. And to be clear, this isn't just Goldman who's making estimates along these lines. This is a consensus opinion.
Yeah,
among estimators.
And it, there's good reason for this. That, again, we have other data that can point us towards where the benchmark revision will go. And so this is just a really good example of why juking the stats is so hard. On top of the fact that BLS employees take their jobs really seriously, if you were putting political pressure on them to change the numbers, we would know about that because they'd be on signal to the press in 30 seconds. It would be instant. On top of that, and you would have to, by the way, if you were going to significantly juke the statistics of something as complicated as the monthly jobs report, you can't just put pressure on one person. It's got to be the entire department because it's such a complicated thing that if you just have one person tweaking something, it's going to be super obvious and inconsistent across the whole data set. So you need to put pressure on a lot of people. There's just no plausible world where that pressure gets put on people and then you don't hear about, oh, they told us to change the number. That's one reason for optimism, is that anybody that gets put into the BLS commissioner role will know that if they try and do that, they're just going to get shown. I mean, it's going to be very obvious right away. And I don't know what markets would do if that actually happened, because the markets didn't really tend to react very much to the news on Friday that this is now a possibility, what with the firing of BLS commissioner, but probably not good.
Yeah. I think this is kind of a piece with the administration's habit of front running news that is going to shift stocks, that increasingly the big casino, the Wall Street, is something that is becoming rigged in certain ways, and that if it reaches a tipping point where people are no longer feeling like they're playing a fair game by investing in the United States, then they're going to move away from investing.
And there was a lot of discussion about that point in March and April, and really before Liberation Day. This was a live thing after J.D. Vance went to Europe and basically said, y'all are on your own. America first, baby, like, suck it. And you basically had the whole continent go, whoa, we're screwed. Okay, we can't invest in the U.S. anymore because we can't depend on them for anything anymore. The evolution of narrative and price is complicated, right? Two things can be true. One, the marginal strength of the U.S. as a destination for global capital can have taken a massive hit, and it can still be a very attractive place for global capital. Look no further than the performance of Meta, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Broadcom, Oracle, these kinds of AI stocks, right? Like that's not happening anywhere else in the global economy. Look at the depth and liquidity of the treasury market. I mean, you just can't get interest rate risk anywhere near as big and liquid anywhere else in the world. So we're sort of seeing we've seen some pricing of nervousness around this, but we haven't seen people really hit the panic button because it hasn't gotten bad enough yet. Does that mean it never will? No, but these things come and go in waves as the narrative builds. And we're still relatively early in the idea that the United States is not somewhere that global capital can come to be invested.
And for my fellow computer touchers, I apologize that he mentioned the O word without proper forewarning, but they do technically count.
Half of CapEx getting plowed into sales, or half of sales getting plowed into CapEx. They exist and they are spending a lot of money on AI.
We've been talking about the Ellisons a lot lately, come to think.
What does Oracle do?
They have like now two major things, one of which is sending, sales and lawyers and sales with lawyers in their mouth after you for all the stuff they've been using forever. And then there's the Oracle Cloud side of things, which is a genuinely compelling tier two cloud, right? Like they're not as big as Azure. They're not as big as AWS or GCP, but they do a good job. And I mean, Microsoft buys from them for GPU compute because Azure is out. I like Oracle Cloud quite a lot, and I am considered an apostate for that well-held position, George.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that Oracle actually does things, because I had sort of put Oracle in the bucket with IBM, where I would see their advertisements and simply think, I don't know what you do.
You don't want to know what IBM does.
It involves Malcolm Gladwell at this point, I think.
Disclaimer, former IBM employee.
My view is that we need to, when the Democrats, inshallah, take back the White House in 2029, we need to pass a law. If you cannot explain what your company does in two or fewer sentences, that's illegal and you're going to prison.
Why not just write a bill of attainder for Larry Ellison personally? I mean, I'm not against this, you know, constitutional questions aside, but like, the funny thing is that like IBM is actually secretly huge again. They make slightly less money than God, and they really wish they made more. It's a weird place to be.
So to bring this back to BLS for a second, I think that the takeaways for people who are not especially invested in economic data are, number one, yes, you can trust things that BLS has said in the past. We would know if they were lying, if we would know if they had already lied to us. And in fact, the firing of the BLS commissioner is a sign that BLS had not previously been co-opted.
100%.
So in some ways that validates the trust we've had in the past over and above the fact that we would be able to tell if they were lying to us. Can we trust what they will say in the future? We spoke about this a little bit already. The answer is maybe.
Near term, yeah. I mean, first off, you have to get somebody. The guy that is the interim BLS commissioner is a acting head of the BLS under two different recent presidents. He was acting head of the BLS under Trump 1 as well as under Biden. He is just well regarded as like a good guy. So as long as he's at the helm, we're good. He won't be forever. Eventually, there will be a Senate-appointed commissioner that, well, I mean, we don't know who this person's going to be, and we don't know, there is a spectrum here. And again, the thing with Trump is like, if your whole thing is everything you have to take everything he says 100% seriously, that's what's going to happen. You're wrong 9 times out of 10, every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Like, he says so much stuff. You cannot possibly be right just saying, well, he said it, so that's what's going to happen. The best recent example of this is the Chair Powell saga, where they tried to retcon a reason to fire Chair Powell for cause after he tried to fire Chair Powell not for cause. Both things have gotten a totally lead balloon welcome from everybody else. And Powell's not getting fired. Like, that's it. I don't want to say, oh, the BLS is fine. I think there is a very high probability that there is going to be a pressure campaign on BLS to change the economic data. We haven't seen it yet, and we may not see it for some time yet. So if you're listening to this, don't think next month, if there happens to be a stronger than expected jobs report, that means they're juking the data now. No, that they will not get someone appointed that quickly through the Senate. That'll take time until that person's appointed, and then a lag after that, because this sort of pressure campaign is going to be hard to wage. You're fighting against a very, very strong set of norms and practices and procedures within the bureaucracy. You can fight with that fight, but everyone's going to know, and it's going to be obvious in the data. It's going to take time. So if you listen to this and you reply to me, but can we trust the economic data still, George, on Blue Sky before there's any evidence that we shouldn't, any hard evidence, any evidence in numbers, any evidence in the procedure to get there?
We're going to get one above expectations job report, and he's going to forget about the whole damn thing.
So while George is over here making up a guy on Blue Sky who probably exists to get mad at, Mr. Speedrun Enjoyer, how about we talk some shit? What do you think of the rumor that this all started, the pressure campaign on one Chair Powell started roughly coincident when the Trump administration found out this? Where is that on your bullshit meter?
So run me through that again.
Blue Sky's most fetid of fever swamps has been bandying around the idea that the pressure campaign on Powell started.
Okay, hold on. Let me stop you right there. This cannot be among Blue Sky's most fetid fever swamps.
I mean, that's okay. True.
Of all the things on Blue Sky, this is nerd shit. there is much crazier shit out there. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Fine. The fetid tide pools of Blue Sky. No superlatives needed. But they've been pushing the idea that the administration found out about this, and that was sort of when they really started pushing on trying to get Powell out.
Well, no, they've been talking about getting rid of Powell for a zillion years now. I mean, Trump is very much a believer. You know, he's fundamentally a real estate developer.
Derogatory.
Heavily derogatory. Like, the most derogatory possible.
Yeah, derogatory. Always derogatory. He's been pushing this for a while. Look, he's a real estate developer. He always wants low interest rates. And he does have an economics degree, if I'm not mistaken, from Penn. From back in the 60s.
They didn't know what economics was in the 60s. Come on.
No, that was, it was better in the 60s than it was in the 80s. Trump very much is of that sort of old, very brain damaged version of Keynesianism, where he just thinks you keep cutting the interest rate and you keep cutting the taxes and line go up. So I don't think the jobs report had anything to do with him wanting to get rid of Powell. He just has wanted to get rid of Powell for a while. When does the president get the jobs report? Does he get it ahead of time?
Yeah, I think Thursday morning.
And it's released Friday morning?
Yeah, I think that's right. Or maybe Wednesday evening. The BLS commissioner does brief him on it, though, or at least historically that's been the case. Who knows what information is actually making it to the Oval Office past Laura Loomer.
Walking in with a pack of Crayola.
I cannot believe Laura Loomer is only 32.
She's only 32?
What?
Yeah.
I'm looking at that
earlier today. Like, that's a hard 32.
3 years
man.
Younger than me is, yeah, that's holy. That's rough.
Oh my. May 21st, 1993.
I am 9 years. 93. She is younger than Pearl Jam's 10. And looks rough. Like that.
Rough.
Evil and, ages you.
Look, there are two kinds of work that you can have done. Tasteful work that takes the years off, and whatever she got.
She got like the gray market Mar-a-Lago makeover. Like this is with the lip fillers and stuff. I don't understand the whole thing. Like why are you making yourself look like you got stung by a bee?
A lot of them, actually. Like multiple bees, yeah.
A lot of them, all of them, like every MAGA.
Why did I look this up? Because I mean, like now, so we've gone from Laura Loomer to apparently, well, I mean, this is still a Loomer. This is still part of the Loomerverse.
I hate that word. I hate that word. We're never using that again. Yeah.
Ed's going to jail for that.
Yeah. Word. Sorry. But, Laura Loomer blasts Tucker Carlson as fraud and terrible person in latest rant, which, I mean, yeah, but tu quoque.
Yeah, see, I thought Loomer was really focused on, like, defense and foreign policy guys, getting them out. Like, I'm waiting for her to have strategy.
The China hawks thrown
out. We have not explained that on this podcast. Propter, do you? Do you have a short one for us, or are you just going to sigh heavily?
Strategy cheese? Are we explaining strategy cheese?
That is a tired look on that man.
We should probably explain both strategy cheese and who Laura Loomer is, because I think, you know, there are people out there who blessedly don't know who we're talking about, and we need to ruin it for them, I think.
All right, you take Laura Loomer, I'll take strategy cheese.
And somehow I got out of this scot-free. Problem solved.
No, Ed, you're gonna tell us who Laura Loomer is, buddy.
Oh, so okay.
The look of pain on Ed's face right now, by the way, is just it's so great. It's delicious.
Where to start? I mean, conspiracy theorist. Let's start there. Far right wing conspiracy theorist. Some kind of internet personality since the Cretaceous period. I think she worked for InfoWars at one point, or at least was just on there a lot. I'm trying to think. I know that she worked with, James O'Keefe. What was the company he got thrown out of? Project Veritas.
That's right.
Just general gadfly until the Trump administration rolled around, or specifically this one, because... And I apologize if you need to skip the next 15 seconds. I understand, but there have been some salacious rumors connecting her and one president, Donald J. Trump. And I apologize for putting that in your brains. But yeah, so she's a terrible person with terrible politics, and they make them in a factory somewhere. I don't know.
Laura Loomer has acted as kind of an HR director without portfolio. For the Trump administration so far. Periodically, she shows up, people get fired, and it's reported afterwards that they got fired because Laura Loomer was mad at them.
wasn't she the one who chained herself to the front door of Twitter?
I was just about to bring that as one of her, one of the two big Loomer lore things. Yes. Loomer was banned from Twitter and went to Twitter's headquarters in San Francisco. I think it was San Francisco or New York. I don't remember. Chained herself to the door and screamed as people filmed her, reporters and stuff filmed her, saying, "I want my Twitter back."
I had never heard the full description of this story, and now I'm hoisted, gentlemen.
Yes. The other great Laura Loomer incident was she was at a party for right-wingers, and Loomer is Jewish. And she walked up to a neo-Nazi. Propter is dying.
He has right sunk here. Back in his chair.
The mic is nowhere in sight. He's pinching his the bridge of his nose. It's just, it's painful.
So Laura Loomer, who is Jewish, walks up to a neo-Nazi and starts hitting on him and tells him about how she has big tits and an Ashkenazi IQ.
And like the hitting on him in the sense of like an OnlyFans model trying to get you to subscribe, not hitting on him in the sense of like normal people hitting on each other, right?
Why did I open this can of worms?
So that's Laura Loomer for you.
Y'all can thank Ed for that, by the way.
Anyway, I'm sure Laura Loomer will be back in the news soon enough and we'll have to deal with her again. I promised a brief explainer on the strategy cheese. The strategy cheese is Elbridge Colby.
That is his real name.
He is currently the Undersecretary for Policy at the Department of Defense. He is the grandson of a former director of one of the predecessor agencies to the CIA. So he is a Washington blue blood in that sense. And he is extremely obnoxious and pretty dim on Twitter regularly, which is kind of how he got the job, and also kind of why NatSec Twitter dislikes him very much. He's in kind of a weird spot in this administration because his past history is that he's a huge China hawk, and that's kind of getting thrown over the side in this administration right now because for various reasons that we might get into on another podcast, the defense establishment has really kind of rolled the Department of Defense into paying attention to everything but China. Bogged down in the Middle East yet again. We are engaged in Ukraine to a greater or lesser extent. But Colby's entire historical thesis is that we need to be focusing everything on the Sea of Taiwan, and we're not doing that.
And also, in case you are moved to go look him up, I'm pretty sure he wrote his Wikipedia page. Seriously, if you read that, like, who else knows this many citations about this?
Never, never a good sign.
Mike Black probably knows that many citations about him.
Oh.
Just because strategy cheese exists to drive him insane.
Poor Mike.
Also got a big profile in, I think it was Politico this past week, where they framed him as somebody that was outside the Washington cocktail set when his whole deal is showing up at cocktail parties.
Have they seen his hair?
It's
this man was decanted in the middle of one of those parties.
Right. He's been going to those parties since he was 15 years old.
They cracked open the cloning vat and just dumped him on the floor. That's the most incredulous thing. I'm just glad he's older than me. That's all I can say.
That's our show for this week. Thanks for listening in. If you get the chance, we'd love it for you to rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. There are a lot of different places you can find it. So hopefully you have the chance to do that, help other people find the show, let us know what we're doing right. We don't care what you think we're doing wrong. No, I'm kidding. We do like negative feedback once in a while.
Man, after that last segment, I feel like we're going to be apologizing is what we're doing wrong.
Probably. I mean, we put a lot of bad images in people's heads. But look, whatever you got to say to write the review, give the rating, do what you think is best. I'm George in Charlotte.
In D.C., I'm Propter.
In outer Florida, I'm low-tech speedrun enjoyer.
And I'm Ed in Boston.
Stay normal, y'all.